This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. France continues to mourn the at least 129 people killed in last Friday's terrorist attacks on Paris. Hundreds more are wounded, and as is the French nation itself. President François Hollande has vowed to, quote, destroy the so-called Islamic State, a very public expression of raw anger and a sense of vulnerability felt on the streets of Paris right now. Well, those feelings, they're familiar here. In fact, this morning at the G20 summit in Turkey, President Obama himself gave voice to something that perhaps many in Boston have been thinking.
We've seen the possibility of terrorist attacks on our soil. There was the Boston Marathon bombers. Obviously, it did not result in the scale of death that we saw in Paris, but that was a serious attempt at killing a lot of people by two brothers and a crock pot. And it gives you some sense of, I think, the kinds of challenges that are going to be involved in this going forward.
That's President Obama today at the G20. Jim Walsh is an expert in international security and with MIT's Securities Studies Program. He wrote To Paris with Love, a Boston perspective on coming back from terror for Cognoscenti, WBUR's opinion and ideas page. And he joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Good to be with you.
So first of all, tell us, what is it about what happened in Paris that made you want to write about, you know, the parallels or the echoes that we may be feeling here in Boston?
Well, I did something a little different this time, and it's what I did when I wrote after the Boston Marathon bombing. I didn't write about, you know, strategy and objectives and how to defeat ISIL and what to do. I was trying to write more about emotions, about what I was feeling inside me, what I felt during the Boston Marathon bombing that played out in Cambridge near me, in Watertown near me. I felt in some ways I owed it that to other people who were, I'm sure, having some of those same feelings.
Mm. I mean, you write that there are many common experiences that you think people in Paris may be having to what we experienced here in Boston, a sense of vulnerability, wondering if any place is safe. Also, just the sort of immediate political uses.
Yeah, I mean, both those things. You know, emotionally, my experience anyway, was that it really ran the gamut and it changed over time. Shock and anger and, you know, defiance. You know, Boston Strong, I think, was about defiance. Emptiness, numbness. You know, why? What a waste this was to have, you know, carried this out. Towards what end? You know, a mix of different emotions that really evolved over time. But, you know, on the ground, as it were, as we were all reeling, there were people on the ground who were doing great things, running towards disaster in Boston, opening their homes in Paris. And then there are other folks who were taking advantage of this opportunity to act out, to attack the defenseless immigrants or people who just simply looked different. And then worse, I think, the manipulators who seize upon the story within 24 hours, without a single fact being established, and then try to manipulate the narrative to promote their own personal ambition, you know, whether it's selling books or candidacies or policy proposals. I don't have a lot of stomach for that.
Mm. You write that even in the face of savagery and inhumanity, people will not give in to the dark or the manipulators who seek advantage. Compassion and solidarity will triumph. Is that your message for Paris?
Absolutely. It's certainly, I think, what we've experienced here. You know, I read this to my daughter. I read the draft of it over the phone, and I got to the part about, you know, they still run something called the Boston Marathon here. And, you know, I got choked up then, as I am now. But I think that is the important thing, is to recognize the goodness in all this, the way people have opened their hearts and been fearless, and then over time how they will put their lives together with, you know, support and in solidarity. I think that's a tribute to the human spirit, and I think that's something we can be proud of.
Jim, you remind us how so much of this is still so close to the surface.
Absolutely.
For all of us. I mean, in a way, sitting here across from you, you're a neighbor, you're a colleague, you're a friend, you're also a security studies expert. I mean, certainly you can understand how there is kind of this immediate natural reaction to say, we have to do something, and we have to do something now. I mean, François Hollande, president of France, said that. He said, this is war. I mean, it does feel very similar to one of the immediate reactions we had here in Boston after the marathon bombing.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on something that's really important, something I've been wrestling with over the last several days. You know, there are going to be a lot more folks that die in car accidents or even in gun violence than will ever die from an act of terrorism. And yet there's just something about it. You know, my logical mind knows that the risk here is really, really, really small. And there are a lot of other dangers that deserve attention. But it does get you at some emotional level, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And that is advantage terrorists, unfortunately, that these acts of violence can have disproportionate effects. But I think it's the job of governments, maybe not the people, but the job of governments to step back and then think about, well, where do we go from here? I can understand, not condone, but understand an individual lashing out in a moment of great emotion. But governments shouldn't lash out. You know, looking at the American experience after 9/11, I mean, one of the great ironies here is that I think that tremendous emotion created a permissive environment that allowed President Bush to lead us into the war in Iraq. And what is one of the consequences of the war in Iraq? The development of ISIL, right? The people who just executed this attack. Now, there are other things involved, too. But clearly, that was a contributing factor.
So we heard this morning the real-time intensity and reality of this exact debate that you're talking about the having to acknowledge the rawness of how individuals might feel versus the responsibility of governments. And it came in the form of President Obama taking multiple questions at the G20 about whether or not the Paris attacks justify or call for a stepped-up military response against ISIS. And he took several questions about this, and he said repeatedly that he believes the fight against ISIS is a long-term campaign and that there will be successes and setbacks. He called Paris a terrible setback. But then he said this to his critics, who he says are calling for what he believes is an unnecessary escalation of military involvement.
But as I said from the start, it's going to take time. And what's been interesting is in the aftermath of Paris, as I listen to those who suggest something else needs to be done, typically the things they suggest need to be done are things we are already doing. The one exception is that there have been a few who suggested that we should put large numbers of U.S. troops on the ground. And keep in mind that, you know, we have the finest military in the world, and we have the finest military minds in the world. And I've been meeting with them intensively for years now, discussing these various options. And it is not just my view, but the view of my closest military and civilian advisors, that that would be a mistake.
All right, Jim, if we can have you put your security studies hat back on here.
I'd rather have that on.
your reaction to what the president said?
Well, I have some sympathy for that. I mean, I've been critical of some policies, but I am sympathetic in this case. I don't see large numbers of U.S. troops. They're going to do what exactly? And how does that help you accomplish your goal? Oh, and by the way, I mean, we should all step back here. If we think that there's this easy military solution, we go in, we kill a bunch of people, and the problem goes away, that's not true. And the irony here is, and we need to brace ourselves for this, the irony is we may, with increasing success against ISIL, that may mean that they do more terrorism, not less terrorism, as terrorism will be one of the few things they'll be able to execute.
Well, so the president sort of laid out almost exactly what you were saying in more detail from, of course, his perspective as commander in chief. He talked a lot about what he believes are vis-a-vis the Syria conflict, what he called, quote, modest progress on the diplomatic front. He believes there's a path forward now in Syria, that the plan should include a transition to an inclusive government, a new constitution, free elections, and a ceasefire to the Syrian civil war, even, quote, as the coalition fights against ISIS. He admitted that, you know, this optimism could all come to a screeching halt if there are more attacks like we've seen in Paris. But he also said he feels more optimistic than he did before. Do you share his optimism on the diplomatic front?
I'm still a skeptic. I think, you know, the conflicts in Iraq and Syria are either going to end because one side wins an overwhelming military victory, that seems unlikely, or because there's a political settlement. Perhaps the terror attacks will adjust the political calculation there. But again, at the end of the day, it's the people on the ground doing the fighting who have to decide to stop shooting. People talk about foreign fighters joining.
Right.
Well, there are millions of refugees leaving, and that points in a completely different direction.
Well, finally, there's one more point that the president made a couple times this morning at the G20 that I want to get your view on, Jim, because he talked about the fact that really one of the goals of the international community should be to reduce the propagandistic power of ISIS. That, you know, the group talks about it creating a caliphate, and that it's their stranglehold on territory is part of what he called a larger narrative. And President Obama said that really what needs to be done is to defeat that narrative. And here's a little bit more from what he said this morning.
You know, we play into the ISIL narrative when we act as if they're a state. And we use routine military tactics that are designed to fight a state that is attacking another state. That's not what's going on here. These are killers with fantasies of glory who are very savvy when it comes to social media and are able to infiltrate the minds of not just Iraqis or Syrians, but disaffected individuals around the world.
And Jim, then right after the president said that, he also added, but we also have to reclaim territory held by ISIS. We have to end the Syrian civil war. And, oh, by the way, we have to bridge the Shia-Sunni divide in Iraq. It's all still bound up together.
Given the U.S. track record in the Middle East, how it's perceived, you know, that is a tough mountain to climb. I mean, regardless of how you feel about what we've done, and people can have all sorts of debates about that, there's no debate about how we're perceived in the region. People look at us as foreign occupiers. Whether you buy it or not, there's no changing that narrative. That narrative is set in stone, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Well, Jim Walsh is an expert on international security and with MIT's Security Studies program. His piece for WBUR's Cognoscenti Opinions and Ideas page is To Paris with Love, A Boston Perspective on Coming Back from Terror. We've got a link to it at radioboston.org. Jim, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So many questions about narratives and ideology, because in dealing with ISIS, there are the military options, which President Obama argues forcefully against. Then there are also the diplomatic, economic, and political options. But then there's the question of religion itself, of Islam, and its role in defeating religious extremism.
I do think that Muslims around the world, religious leaders, political leaders, ordinary people have to, you know, ask very serious questions about how did these extremist ideologies take root. Even if it's only affecting a very small fraction of the population, it is real. And it is dangerous. And it has built up over time. And with social media, it is now accelerating.
That's President Obama once again at the G20 in Turkey just this morning. So let's turn now to Jocelyn Cesari. She's director of the Islam in the West program at Harvard. She's also professor of religion and politics at the University of Birmingham, and she joins us today from Birmingham, England. Jocelyn Cesari, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. May I first just ask and for your response to what that piece of tape we just played from President Obama, that he asks Muslims around the world to ask very serious questions about extremist ideologies and what to do about them.
Yes, it's a very good angle to start with. I would just say that it's not the Muslims as such, but the leadership, the religious leadership, that have to be seriously addressed. I think we have witnessed in the last 50 years, the collapse of the credibility of traditional religious leaders in Islam, leaving the room for young people like the one we are seeing acting at ISIS or Al-Qaeda, who do not have real credentials in terms of religious studies or training, but have a vision of what Islam should be or should do. And this is a very, very dangerous situation, because we have lots of these leaders, traditional leaders, condemning. Nobody listens.
Jocelyn Cesari, are you still with us? Oh, looks like we lost her line there to Birmingham, England. We'll try to get her back, but while we can, let's turn the story back to what's happening here in the United States for a moment, because there has been reaction to the news that at least one of the Paris attackers who entered bombed the soccer stadium on Friday, he entered Europe last month by falsely declaring himself to be a Syrian refugee. So today, governors in at least 13 states, including New Hampshire, Ohio, Texas, and Florida, say they're no longer willing to take in Syrian refugees. Well, this morning, Governor Charlie Baker added Massachusetts to the list.
No, I'm not interested in accepting refugees from Syria. I would need to know a lot more than I know now before I would agree to do anything.
Now, individual states can't actually stop the federal government from resettling refugees, but Baker went on to say that he needs to know more about how those refugees will be screened.
Any conversation that involves this has to start with whatever process the federal government is going to put in place to vet people through that process, and that's something we'd certainly want to know a lot about. I think at this point in time, we would have to be very cautious about accepting folks without knowing a lot more about what the federal government's plan looks like and how it would actually be implemented and executed on.
Well, the gubernatorial unease reached the G20 today. President Obama was in Turkey, but he spoke directly to the concerns of governors back in the United States.
One of the places that you're seeing this debate play itself out is on the refugee issue. Both in Europe and, I gather, it started popping up while I was gone back in the United States. The people who are fleeing Syria are the most harmed by terrorism. They are the most vulnerable as a consequence of civil war and strife. They are parents. They are children. They are orphans. And it is very important, and I was glad to see that this was affirmed again and again by the G20, that we do not close our hearts to these victims of such violence and somehow start equating the issue of refugees with the issue of terrorism.
But of course, in politics, nothing is ever that simple. Donald Trump has likened refugees to, quote, a Trojan horse. And former Florida Governor Jeb Bush has suggested that the United States accept only Christian Syrians into the country. Now, to be clear, Governor Charlie Baker has suggested no such thing. But here's how President Obama responded to those ideas.
And so I think it is very important for us right now, particularly those who are in leadership, particularly those who have a platform and can be heard, not to fall into that trap, not to feed that dark impulse inside of us. Now, I had a lot of disagreements with George W. Bush on policy, but I was very proud after 9/11 when he was adamant and clear about the fact that this is not a war on Islam. And the notion that some of those who have taken on leadership in his party would ignore all of that . That's not who we are.
That's President Obama at the G20 today. Once again, governors in at least 13 states, including Massachusetts, have said they want to stop Syrian refugees from relocating to their states. There's more of the show ahead in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Before the break, we were attempting to have a conversation with Jocelyn Cesari. She's director of the Islam in the West program at Harvard and professor of religion and politics at the University of Birmingham. We got cut off there, but Jocelyn Cesari, I hear that we have you back. Are you there?
Yes, I am back. Okay, good.
Apologies for the technical difficulties here. So we were talking about the question of Islam itself and political leaders in the Muslim community and their role in defeating or pushing back extremist ideologies. And I wanted to play once again a little bit of tape from President Obama this morning at the G20 when he addressed specifically this issue. So let's listen once again.
I do think that Muslims around the world, religious leaders, political leaders, ordinary people, have to ask very serious questions about how did these extremist ideologies take root. Even if it's only affecting a very small fraction of the population, it is real. And it is dangerous. And it has built up over time. And with social media, it is now accelerating.
Well, Jocelyn Cesari, we were hearing your answer to the question that I asked a little earlier, and that is, what is your reaction to the fact that the president has so specifically asked Islamic political leaders to play a role here?
Yes, I think that there is a necessity for political and religious leaders alike to look into the transmission, the education in Islam, and how the traditional teaching have been discredited over and over in the last 50 years. Something happened in the tenets and the way that this Islamic tradition is taught that has discredited the basic teachings in favor of political radical messages. And I think indeed it's a responsibility of all Muslims, states, but also religious leaders. And it means that we cannot have only a military response. We need a more organized attempt to create or to make available to the youth of Islam everywhere the Islamic tradition. We talk a lot about reform. I don't think reform is the solution.
Well, excuse me, Jocelyn Cesari, may I jump in here? Because what do you mean by reform is not the solution? Because I think many people observing this from the outside are calling for exactly that, some sort of Islamic reformation.
If I say that the interpretation of Islam on which ISIS is building its violent strategy is a reform already, it has been changed, it has been taken away from the Islamic tradition, it's a modern, dating back from the 19th century, new way of dealing with the text. It is not modernist, it is not liberal, but it's a reform. So the problem is that these people present themselves as the authentic traditional Islam, and that there are very few responses from Muslim leaders to contest that. I'm talking about Muslim religious leaders. And this is the problem. And we need to go back to a broader, more pluralist approach to what is Islam. And there are multiple interpretations in Islam.
Well, Jocelyn Cesari, forgive me for interrupting once again, but you're just saying so much that's so very interesting, because I am curious. You just said, if I heard you correctly, that we haven't heard enough from Islamic religious leaders in opposition to the extremist ideologies that have been coming out over the past several decades. And I feel like many people would agree with you that what we hear are, or maybe what we hear at least in the media, are reports of the preachings of extremist clerics, whether it be, you know, those from within the Middle East itself, or those funded by Middle East money who are then preaching in places like France, in England, where you are. Why is it that perhaps we haven't heard enough then from non-extremist clerics with the same intensity, the same passion?
First reason is that in Muslim majority countries, this traditional elite is dependent on the state. They are on the payroll of the state. What does it mean? It means that they have a very politicized situation, and that the young people do not trust them, because the states in the last 50 years have not shown a lot of democracy opening or tolerance. So this is already there, a big handicap for these people who have condemned. I can find you lots of fatwas condemning terrorism and the use of jihad by Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The problem is nobody listening to them, because they are not considered legitimate enough or authentic enough to do that. And then you have the rest of Muslims who attempt on their own in different areas to promote a return to the sources, a return to the tradition, but nobody listened to them really. And in the West, the leaders that are at the head of Islamic institutions have a political position as well. They have been carefully selected by the European states, and they have a position to fulfill. So what the hope would be to have a mobilization of citizens, Muslim citizens, but with other faiths as well, to create platforms for exchange. And I'm saying that not out of the blue. I'm seeing emerging again, we're talking about the use of social media by ISIS. Mm. I'm also starting to see the use of social media by young people who are saying it's enough, we have to reclaim our tradition.
Right. So can you tell me a little bit more about that? Because I feel like in extremist ideologies, we often hear of the ummah, right? The worldwide body of Islam, and that an attack against one Muslim is an attack against all.
Yeah.
Certainly the exact mirror image is true with the same worldwide body of Islam, that they can come together, maybe as you're saying, through young people and social media, and say an attack on Islam by extremists is an attack on all Muslims.
Absolutely. And exactly in this term that I can see now some forms of mobilization and attempt to recover the richness of the Islamic tradition. I give you just an example. After Charlie Hebdo, a group of these young people outside the establishment of the clerical organization have created a movement called Enough with the Silence. And these are all young people all over Europe trying to also connect with Muslim leaders, having the same kind of approach in Malaysia, in other Muslim countries. And they are saying we need all together, but also with our fellow in other faiths, to bring up the knowledge and the scope of the Islamic tradition to the young people. Mm. Because ISIS and Al-Qaeda operate on a very, very narrow approach that is not connecting with the tradition. They say they are authentic, but they are not traditional. And this is a very, very important point. What is needed is to reopen the plurality of sources in the Islamic history, and
right.
this is gone. And I think this is the most worrisome. And the problem is that this kind of discourse is very difficult in international situations that are dominated by secular interest. But the more I observe the evolution since 9/11, the more I am convinced that we cannot only respond by secular means to a religious discourse. The people in Paris were mobilized on religion, not only on secular concerns about, you know, the politics in Iraq or Syria, despite what we try to say.
Right.
They really think that Islam is in danger.
Well, Jocelyn, if I may, I'm so sorry to interrupt once again, but I do have one last question before we have to
please,
let you go.
Please.
Are you, if I hear correctly, are you French as well?
Yes.
Okay. Can you please, yes. I'm just curious, how, you're French, you're very knowledgeable in all of this. How urgent do you think this need is for the worldwide Islamic community, or even just, we can focus in France, for this renewed type of conversation, religious conversation to happen? How urgent is it?
It is now. Actually, it should have even started yesterday. It is something we have to do it's urgent. Let's put it this way. It should start right away. Again, it doesn't mean we have to stop military actions. It means that we have to think differently of the way we are projecting ourselves in the international community.
And if it doesn't happen urgently, what's the consequence?
A greater and greater polarization of young people thinking that their faith, not only their body or their material interest, but their faith and soul is in danger.
Well, Jocelyn Cesari is director of the Islam in the West program at Harvard University. She's also a professor at the University of Birmingham in England. She's joining us today from Birmingham, England. Jocelyn Cesari, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.